Willkommen zum Podcast der Initiative Regenerative Marktwirtschaft. Hier wollen wir herausfinden, wie man eine umweltfähige Zukunft macht.
Welcome to today's episode of the podcast for the Initiative for the Regenerative Market Economy. And today, my guest here is Alexa. We met a while ago, only a few months, I think, in Stockholm, briefly. And I immediately knew that you would have a broad perspective on the kinds of questions we ask in this podcast here, in this conversation. And this is why I wanted to invite you and learn about those perspectives. So welcome, Alexa.
Thank you for having me, Thomas. It's wonderful to be here.
And as usual, I'm not even going to attempt to describe you. To not only because I don't know very much about you, but also because it is not appropriate and for me or any other person to describe another person. I think that's your job and your job to show us who you are and who you want us to see and convey through what lens you're looking at this conversation and the questions so that we can understand better. So who are you?
Thank you for the question. I have a bit of a paradox in answering your question in this way, and I must give a caveat. You know, it's that I think that one of the things that really damages our earth is a sense of ego and a sense of the I. And I've been fortunate to have received teachings that have been very important in my life from Eastern traditions and principally Dzogchen Buddhism. And so my morning practice entails dissolving the sense of the I or the sense of the self. So whenever I have to speak about who I am, or even just when that question gets asked, I get a little like janky short circuit in my system because it's like I'm looking out the window and there's trees and waves. And I feel like I am more that than anything I'm about to speak about what this identity is. Mm-hmm. So with that caveat, which just feels honest to share, mm-hmm. I am Alexa, and Swiss and Swedish by birth. Most of my professional work has centered on bringing human systems and ecological systems into greater harmony. I'll start with where I am currently. Currently, I'm managing three initiatives, or two and a half. The first one is I'm a co-director of an initiative at the Crowder Lab in ETH Zurich, which is a science and engineering-focused university in Zurich. And we study global ecosystem ecology, so the relationship between biodiversity and climate change. And the project that I'm co-directing is developing the world's most holistic and high-resolution measure biodiversity for anywhere on the planet. It's a combination of global data layers with remote sensing satellite data and ground truth. And the idea with that is to try and steer financial and political systems into having a different relationship with the living world. I'm also managing a portfolio of capital that is investing on behalf of nature. It's an animist investment vehicle, if you will. So it's attempting very imperfectly to invest on behalf of other beings and of ecosystems and of life. And we have blended forms of capital, so everything from grants to for-profit investments, spanning different categories, so Earth living systems, things like regenerative agriculture and rewilding and soil and biodiversity, to legal mechanisms like the rights of nature, Earth jurisprudence, activism, journalism, scientific research, and also a new vein of work that we're opening starting next year around human consciousness or inner development. So our sort of psychology, if you will. And that's hugely rewarding and beautiful work. And yeah, I also started a podcast last year called Life Worlds, which is focused on our relationship to other life. So a lot of the climate and biodiversity movement is quite anthropocentric. You know, we need these ecosystems to support the human endeavor to keep surviving and thriving, but with ground effect, we read with ground effects investment vehicle. With Life Worlds, we ask the question, you know, what does nature value? Can we bring those voices to the table? Who are those constituencies? So I speak with incredibly inspiring people in many different fields of practice all around sort of regeneration of life and ecosystems. But I ask how they learn to embody this, well, how they develop the skills and practices and how they learn to embody the life worlds of these ecosystems, of these other beings. So it's a sort of more than human, decentered perspective, which I think is really critical. So it's, and I think it goes without saying that, yeah, our world is steeped in a lot of duality. And so the more that we can learn to embody the perspective of others, the more that we can generate care and empathy, which will become increasingly important. So yeah, that's what I'm currently doing.
That's what you're currently doing, yes. And thank you for the caveat in the beginning. I mean, it is important to denote that in conversations like this. I agree. At the same time, you exist, and you're playing a role in this thing called life. And in a way, you even have an obligation to understand who you are in that ecosystem of life, just like a cell in your body has to make a decision what that cell is going to be. A big toe cell has nothing to do in the heart, right? So what cell are you in that broader context? So thank you for both the caveat and laying it out. You're holding a lot of different things. And by the way, the podcast that I can totally recommend to everybody, it's both scientific and poetic and deep. It's become one of my favorites. So it's really beautiful. You're holding a broad spectrum, right? And I just said it in the podcast, it feels to me like a playground where you're exploring all of these different facets of Alexa. And I'm wondering, can you give us a little perspective into the tensions maybe that created, out of which you emerged, that give us a deeper sense of who you are?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd say the red thread between those activities is how human beings relate to the natural world. You know, I don't invest in a lot of climate tech. I don't reduce the living world to carbon in my mind or in my way of seeing. How I got there, I believe, is an understanding of this kind of trauma of separation, if you will, that we've had as human beings. We've been so profoundly cut off from our landscapes. And by our landscapes, I don't mean they belong to us, but I mean like, you know, in the way like we have our family. We've been so cut off from human social interactions that are meaningful and not mediated by market exchange. And there's just this deep separation at the heart of, I think, a lot of the quote-unquote polycrisis or meta-crisis that we face. And you're right in what you said, that the self is an elusive concept, but we do have signatures, right? We do have these imprints mm-hmm. that move us from often very young in life. Mine has been a relationship to nature, quote-unquote nature, that which we are. And as a kid growing up in the forest and really outdoors and not having many friends and being very geeky, I made friends with all the squirrels and all the animals. And it always was, you know, the most natural place for me to be. And as I grew up, I couldn't understand why people perpetuated the harms that they did against each other and against the living world. Mm. So it's been an inquiry. I studied political science. I wanted to understand, you know, global systems and how they operate. I worked in journalism. I worked in land-based conservation projects here in Mexico, where I'm speaking to you from today, a land that I'm very connected mm-hmm. to. Understanding, you know, restoration, ecosystem protection, what does it mean to actually bring places back to life? Mm. And through that inquiry, it was also very clear that the damage was happening upstream inside of power structures, inside of economic structures, but also inside of our minds. So my last 2 years in Mexico, around 2017 to 2019, I was running a company that was doing learning journeys that we founded. And we were bringing key decision makers, executives, investors, leaders, quote unquote, into the land for these kind of deep ecology experiences to try and encourage that cultivation of, yeah, just remembrance, right? Of like that which we are. So that all kind of comes together, I guess, you know, with the investment, it's understanding that we have approaches that we can scale and replicate and support today. They have to try and be a little bit subversive somehow to the dominant system, all the while trying to steer it differently. And yeah, I would say that working with the lab emerged because we were supporting research on fungi on the mycelium. Mm-hmm. And hear that? No,
it was fun.
On the fungi. And that serendipitous encounter led me to the lab where I was working today. They were looking to hire a co-director for this initiative. And I realized through a lot of my other work that the way that we were measuring and understanding biodiversity was so broken, and that if we weren't to embed a much more holistic understanding of what nature is into these systems, we would commit a lot of harm when we start to scale up biodiversity credit systems and all of these new mechanisms for financing nature. So yeah, see, my work is a combination of the very practical applied science investment with always this deeper understanding that we must try and work on psychology as much as possible.
Beautiful. Now, that platform is much, much broader. I don't understand Alexa yet, but I see much more. And what I see is that you're driven by curiosity, a drive to understand, try to at least understand the first principles that got us into the current predicament of our species. And from there, you seem to see some pointers of how we can start rediscovering how we can do things in a more aligned way with nature and the planet and ourselves. Mm-hmm. Right, you pointed to that as well. And in that, I'm pretty sure that you have also pondered and went into an inquiry around the question of how do we measure good life? Right? Many people point to wealth and see the ultimate abstraction in money that's usually coded by the word wealth. But usually, and specifically in this context of this conversation, we see much more than money behind wealth. And from your journey, from your perspective, from what you're seeing, from the conversations you have with other people who are also thinking and acting deeply around these things, how would you describe wealth in the sense of a good life?
I think it's like when you build an ecology or a garden or a way of forest gets built, like there's all these layers, no? And if we're talking about just the human species right now, I think if our minds are sick, it's hard to appreciate anything. And I think the reason why I'm thinking that way is something happened over the last days in my life here, which just relates this subject of mental health. And someone very close to me got suddenly very sick, and they, you know, 1 or 2 days really lost their mind. And I wasn't sure if they were going to come back. And, you know, it was a parent, so it was very, very close to me. And thankfully they're back, but their mind had just gone. And it really made me understand and value this concept of like, what is it to be sane, or what is it to be lucid, or to be aware? And it made me think a lot about mental health in general and the cascading sort of crises that we'll be seeing, even though they'll be filled with opportunity and growth. Yeah, so for me, that the base of wealth starts with the mind initially. That's the soil from which things are built, right? And human beings having we're like a Pandora's box or a Russian doll, I don't know, pick your metaphor of like complications, right? Human beings, there's like so many versions of us inside of ourselves. But like having basic emotional stability and not being deeply traumatized or epigenetically, you know, traumatized across generations, having access to being able to witness the world with some clarity and make decisions not based off impulse or reactivity, but like this capacity to have either a spiritual life that gives you that, whatever your religion or belief system may be, but also access to tools, right, that allow us to process things that are challenging for us, to heal things that may need to be healed, to learn how to come into constructive, collaborative conversation together and not just, you know, narrative warfare or xenophobia or breakdown. I think like, yeah, if the soil of the mind isn't sane and isn't fertile, then many of the other forms of wealth don't take hold. Obviously, within this, wealth is also health. And it's, are we eating clean food, breathing clean air? Do we have access to clean water? I think most of the listeners of your show will know, you know, we're past 6 of these 9 planetary boundaries. And many of them, you know, some of them have to do with nitrogen flows around the planet or forever chemicals. Like we have deeply, deeply created toxicity on the earth and therefore inside of ourselves. And that toxicity pollutes our bodies and our minds as well. So access to just clean, decent living, it can be humble, it can be simple. I mean, you know, for me, I would want it to be humble and simple, but everyone has the right to have a basic access to that version of health that arises out of an environment, a natural world that itself is healthy. And this brings me to the point, which is wealth is also not just human wealth, but are all the other species thriving and existing? Because we exist in that web of relationships. And so it's like our body, you know, if one organ is dying or unwell, you can't pretend that you're healthy. And so we can't look out at a landscape where, you know, 95%, I think it is, right, of the mammalian biomass on the planet are the mammals that humans are ourselves and the mammals that humans create for food, right? So poultry, chickens, etc., cows. Mm-hmm. Like we have 5% of these wild creatures left. That's like a whole organ that's offline. That's like a whole, well, what would you call it? Connective layer of our own bodies that's missing. So we can't have human wealth without other beings and species and life processes also having access to their migratory routes, their homes, their places to feed, their places to live. And we've sort of forced them into these enclaves and we call them national parks or conserved areas. And we're like, here you can live. You know, it mirrors exactly what we've done to our human brothers and sisters, right, with reservations. And so wealth needs to involve a reckoning with that and a reckoning with the fact that we share this earth with other life. And what does that actually look like? And then not all of these resources are for us to take or for us to use, but we have to share. Measurement is an interesting question because I think that when you have a good life, it's based on the relationships you have with others around you. It's based, actually, the last thing I'll say, which is a bit different to the rest, is I think a sense of purpose brings a good life. You know, as you said, we're all born here with some little ecosystem niche to fill, you know, some soul desire to bring something into the world, whatever it is, you know. I think that one can only have a good life when we feel embedded in a web of reciprocal relationships and we're serving some larger whole through that unique signature that is ours that we came here to do or that we're here to do, it's interesting when you think of things like universal basic income, because then you start to think, okay, well, if people had the freedom and the flexibility to do anything they wanted, you know, many people say, oh, they'll just be lazy and sit around. I think humans need to produce and do something and make something or express themselves and to tend to this world, right? So I think without a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning, you can't have a good life. But those other conditions are, I think, important to be able to start to even move towards that.
when you were speaking to the mind, and thank you for sharing this fresh and probably painful experience. I was wondering about, what do you have in mind when you talk about the mind? And because I want to frame that and reciprocate with a story. Almost to the day, 2 years ago, my mother died. And in the weeks before, we had very, very good and deep conversations. And I asked her about an insights that she's had throughout her life. And she said that she was experiencing one at that moment. And that one was that she could sense how deeply interwoven, interconnected body, mind, and soul are. Because with her fading body, she could feel her fading, her mind fading, and her soul fading. And I asked her, so what's the soul in this? And she gave me, to this day, most precise definition that I've been using ever since. And that is that the soul is to feelings what the mind is to thoughts. Now, if I use that and then bring Daniel Kahneman into this and say, well, we're making about 90-95% of our decisions based on heuristics expressed as feelings, then maybe what we also need is the same soul. And I'm pretty sure that your definition of the mind somehow includes that, but I wanted to explore that a little. What is your understanding of that thing, the mind, because you put it at the center?
Yeah, it's an important clarification, because we do today associate the mind with mental activity and the brain. I really like this idea of extended cognition, or like the spider and the web, right? Is the spider just a spider, or is it the web? Because at the end of the day, it feels the tremble, right? From, you know, like through its little legs, from, you know, some little fly that arrived. And one would say, is the spider's mind in its body, or is the spider's mind in the web? Is the whale's mind in its body, or is it in the ocean that it's traversing? We are the same as this. I think that our mind is inside of our bodies, inside of other energetic phenomenon that we create by being humans and alive, you know, electromagnetics and others. And all of that is our kind of whole body, mind, soul complex. But it's also the landscapes that we inhabit, and it's the topologies that we walk through, and it's possibly even extends the relationships that we hold. So if I go back to what I responded earlier, I see the mind as what's happening in our brains and how our bodies interpret the world around us and process that. And that is also physiological and in the brain. And it's something a lot more etheric and nebulous, which I think is what your mother was kind of pointing to in a very, very beautiful insight.
Which ties back to what you said very early in our conversation today of the interconnectedness and interbeing with the entire world. So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that true wealth is having a sane mind and a sane, healthy body. And that is largely a function of your embeddedness in a healthy environment, other beings, other humans, life as a whole. Now that is, if I try to envision this, which I do in my own images right now here, very, very far away from how we are doing things right now as humanity. And at the same time, when I have these conversations, I hear very, very similar descriptions from almost everyone. Which leads me to the assumption that if we just unlock some of the things that are holding us back, some of the power structures you pointed towards earlier, and reshift ourselves to something else, to new
generative functions, first principles that help us build up a more sane, or not only a more, but a sane world, then that could actually happen very quickly because we all carry it within us already. But what are the conditions of this world in your mind? What are some of the things that you would fundamentally change from everything you've learned about in being in the world and in being active in helping the world move towards something better? What are the things that we need to change? What could be a good outline for how we do things, our operating system, our economy, our civilization, our societies?
When you ask that question, I ask myself the question, when have things been more optimal or where? You know, in what moments of time in history? One of the things I find challenging is that so much of the forces of inertia and, in a way, like the autopoietic nature of these current systems, as some of our friends have outlined very well, you know, whether you want to call it superorganism or Moloch or whatever it is, it's just become this autopoietic superstructure that keeps replicating itself through our minds, through its. And so, you know, I've just asked for a long time, like, what, right? How, like, when did that emerge? And it's just, you know, you can put your stake in the moment in time. Is it back, you know, sedentary agriculture? Is it, you know, the VOC first creating bonds and setting out and colonizing? Is it, you know, like, because I think it is important to understand where we've come from to begin to answer a question like that. I'm beginning to believe more in the necessity for subversive actions, as I mentioned before, and we've become consumers. We're no longer citizens as human beings. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, you've mentioned to me citizen assemblies, and I think that enabling humans to realize that they have agency and that no matter who they are, they have something meaningful to say and to share. I think citizen assemblies and participatory democratic structures and institutions really are supportive in helping people to understand, oh, I'm not just a butcher, or I'm not just a, you know, whatever it is, a carpenter, plumber, teacher. I really have something meaningful to contribute to the future of this land that I call home, wherever that land is. So engaging more people inside of contexts where they understand the agency that they hold and the collective power, not the individualized I power, but the power of the collective. I mean, that can take the form of, you know, very well-run civil citizen assemblies like you've seen in the UK around the Plan for Nature, People's Plan for Nature, or it can be global protest movements. And I think that when you look at the most important advances that have happened in the last century, they've happened via protest and demonstrations. Mm-hmm. I don't actually think, probably many happened behind closed doors and we don't know as much about them. But the conference of rights, the conference of dignity happened through that. So because I don't think that the most sociopathic people who hold power today are going to let go anytime soon, and we can wait for them to die and new generations to come in, but we can't expect that they haven't indoctrinated those younger generations already. I think there's something about the power to the people, mm-hmm. and enabling people to stand up for what they want. There are many hacks that you can do inside of this current system. In the space that I work in, climate and biodiversity, I could list a ton of them. You know, everything from true cost accounting, pricing, externalities, transparency, MRV, monitoring, reporting, verification, like really exposing who the worst actors are and where the harm is happening and removing their social license to operate. It's a bit different to what I mentioned earlier. This is like, you know, in COP, Al Gore, just now COP28, Al Gore just launched relaunched with a much more complete database, Climate Trace, which is the world's largest kind of open source of GHG emissions for a lot of the industrial sites around the world. Increasingly, it's going to become difficult for companies to say, I didn't know, or, oh, it's impossible for me to track my supply chain. So I think that some advances in technology will allow us much greater transparency, much greater ability to mobilize, much greater ability to penalize. And as a consumer, you can also start saying, I didn't, you know, you can no longer say as much, I didn't know.
Mm-hmm. What I'm hearing is that, yeah. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
No, of course not. I'm not touching here on where the core of the change needs to come from, which is inside of our psychology, because I don't want my answers to be too intangible or high level, but we can't tackle the question that you asked without looking at education, and education from the first moments of life to corporate education, MBAs, high schools, like fundamentally how we train human beings, or a teacher, you know, educare, to draw out the way of being out of human beings. So we could also talk about education, but
I would like to go into the true cost accounting aspect. But mm-hmm. before that, I want to see whether I get the gist properly of what you were describing. And I'm sensing that you're pointing towards several things. One, we humans, the majority, 97% not in the dark triad, for example, we know what is the right thing to do, but we're trapped in this self, in this thing that is strengthening itself, the multipolar trap that is moving into a position of increasing power for itself. We're trapped in not knowing that the others are actually seeing it the same way. In a similar way as, and the hacks that came to mind was when in Serbia, the people were trying to get rid of Milosevic. One of the things they did to show other people that they were not listening to and not believing in the propaganda of the people in power was that they took their television sets for an evening walk during the time of the evening news, right? Just to show everybody, I'm not into this. And nobody could stop them from taking their television sets on a walk, right? It's a very playful, fun, but very clear message. And what I'm hearing is that there might be something like that, that we can start coordinating, but it's not yet there. But I'm hearing that you say that the coherence between the people is there. We just have to find a way to activate it into something more beautiful.
I love that story of the TVs. Maybe we can scheme before we get off this podcast of what we can launch. Yes, and maybe a slight clarification. You know, you said 97% of people know what to do. I don't know. I think that people who live close to land know how to look after land. But I don't think that 97% of people know what to do. I don't think that, you know, pick your country. Some countries, 60% of people don't think that climate change is real. There are such fundamental disagreements accelerated, right, and weaponized by technology and all the things that you know that pit people against themselves. And with this barrage of false information and fake news and the fact it's just going to get worse and worse, I just don't think that people know what to do. I don't know what to recycle anymore, because in some bottles, you know, there's two types of plastics and you don't know which ones. And if it really goes into the dump site, you know, there's all these compostable bins, but you don't know if your little fork is for the industrial one. Like, it's actually really like the day to day, it makes it very hard for just normal people, average people. There's no average person, but, you know, citizens, to know what to do the right thing. Do I get an electric car? But it's actually more, it could be more fossil fuel intensive or more intensive on the earth, depending where it was mined, right? Like, the moment you wake up, you have to consume to live and exist inside of the system. And the moment you consume, it's super confusing. So I don't think that many people know what it is that they can do. I think that many people don't know the power that they could have if they got together. This is a bit different. And I think that many people disagree on what the best thing is to do, even when they're very informed. I mean, I work inside of an academic science lab, and I can tell you, you know, academia constantly disagrees, even though they're all aiming towards the right, you know, the right thing or, you know, shared goal. So I think there's a basic sort of capacity for making sense of the world that is also deeply missing.
That's why you bring in education.
Yeah.
As a, yeah. And with that, also the creation of coherence that we're sorely missing through the, because of the fragmentation that we've experienced through its driven internet. And that's kind of education. In order to be able to be bootstrapped requires some vision of, or some picture of, a narrative of a world that it should educate into.
Yeah.
And so also here, it's a bootstrapping system autopoetically creating itself if you know where you want to go, because all parts of it create itself at the same time simultaneously and reinforcing mutually. That's how that would work. But in all these aspects, the narrative seems to be missing. Right? Is that right? Because when I say 97% of the people, I mean they feel something's off. They don't know how to activate it, maybe. So that's where the narrative might be missing. They don't know what to activate. That's where the narrative is missing. Mm-hmm. And maybe also that's why coordination is so difficult, because what do you coordinate around if you don't have anything to coordinate around? Well, how do you tell others that you're on that side and not on the other side, or however you want to put it? Okay.
I'll add something.
Yeah,
please. I think that there's an art in knowing how to ask the right questions first, mm-hmm. and that's just mm-hmm. basic training of humans. Things that I see that do work well or better are focused efforts according to the way that nature structures itself or herself. I'll explain what I mean. I'm sure you'll have people on the podcast talking about bioregionalism, but watersheds have a very logical function. Bioregions, which are regions of the earth that have some sort of, how do you say, sort of biological raison d'être within itself, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can think of like a microclimate as a sort of analogy of that. They have some kind of cultural ecological coherence to them that it makes sense to work at a bioregional level. So there are certain interventions we can do that tip systems into different states on high levels, things like global taxation or debt structures or these kinds of overarching multilateral mechanisms. But I think for most people, operating on a bioregional level and thinking on a bioregional scale is just healthy. It's just like what humans have done for a very long time. And within that, you can create very coherent landscape plans. You bring humans together, you facilitate a process whereby they come up with a common vision for their watershed or their land, and you find often that there's more alignments than disagreements. You don't have to agree in climate change to agree that you want healthy water for the salmon to swim up, right? For example. You can disagree, we want healthy water, we want salmon, whether you're the hunter or the, you know. So work on a bioregional scale to create these sorts of integrated landscape management plans, which then brings together that civic process I described earlier. That's where I think people can begin to practice that muscle and that skill of collaborating, cohering, asking right questions, and learning that they have agency and learning how they want to act.
But that's, if at all possible, for about half of the population, because the rest lives in cities, and cities are not really, you can see them as a bioregion, but they don't have the capacity to feed the people. That's the nature of a city, right? So they're not a fully functioning bioregion in and of themselves.
It's an excellent point. It's an excellent point. Cities, by the way, are an incredible acupuncture point as well. Like, I'm sure you've been tracking the C40 city movement, and cities getting their act together is hugely important in catalytics. So that's a very, very good point. It's a different approach. But I think that because of the economies of scale, you can do a lot in terms of cities.
So some cities are moving into that direction. You said that. And for example, you know that about 70 cities, city governments are actively working with Kate Raworth on getting into the donut because they can and they must, and they know that. Right? So, and that is a way of looking at the balance sheet, if you will, of a city holistically. So they're attempting something like true cost accounting or full cost accounting because they can, because they're not really in the competition, in the for-profit competition as a company might be, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you also mentioned true cost accounting. And if any company at the current point in time and the current situation in global regulation attempts to start winning by engaging in true cost accounting, they will not win, because winning currently is defined by profit maximization.
Mm-hmm.
And true cost accounting doesn't allow that in that same singular measure. So what do you think of when you think of true cost accounting, and why does it matter?
Yeah, another very good point. I think that there are transitional measures that we need to put in place until we create some new economic system that looks very different to what we have today. True cost accounting is one of those things. Additional to the point you made, which I'd like to elaborate a little bit on. If most, a paper came out from IPBS about this a few months ago, if most global companies were to, actually, don't quote me on IPBS, it might not be from them, but it was from one of these high-level scientific bodies. If most companies today were to factor in the true cost of their ecological debts and social debts and externalities, they would be revenue negative or they would go bankrupt, right? So there's a natural limit to what true cost accounting can do, because if you were to do it, quote unquote, perfectly, which you never could, because, you know, there's immeasurable factors in every single input, it would crash, right? The company. That said, you were speaking about a race to the bottom dynamic, right? Which is like, well, the fisherman next door doesn't go out and overfish, but then I'll just go out in the night and get all the fish in the bay. The way that that can be constrained or binded is via regulation or governance.
Mm-hmm.
And we are seeing today the emergence of norms, binding norms and rules and regulations around what companies are discounting or are accounting for. Mm-hmm. So you had TNFD, Task Force for Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, launched in September. It's a series of guidelines for global corporations to disclose their impacts, risks, and dependencies on nature. And it's likely that mandatory disclosures on our impacts to nature will be put in place in the coming years. This emerged out of the COP in Montreal, the biodiversity COP. So it is very possible that in the future, companies will be having to disclose a hell of a lot more than they ever had to. And that makes the accounting not perfectly honest, but a lot more honest, because you can't just extract in the same way you were before, right? Those impacts and risks and dependencies will be shown to investors and stakeholders. And in the end of the day, they'll see that business actually has a much shorter runway. So the pricing of that company will begin to change vis-a-vis its competitors. So we are working with the lab with a few companies, global food and ag companies, forestry companies, who are beginning to account for their impacts on nature and measure that indifferently. On the plus side, there are a lot of interesting initiatives that are starting to measure, well, if we're regenerating, that's a positive on the balance sheet, right? It's never been. Mm-hmm. And so can we quantify and validate and reward that uplift positively on the balance sheet? So not just the negative things. All of that has tremendous capacity, I think, to shift this current system into something different for a while, but to start to offset some of the worst harms that we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that that could be a bridge into something, because in the sense that I got around your definition of wealth, quantification doesn't have a space to me, at least in my understanding of that wealth. Yeah. So even if you quantify the positive externalities, if you want the positive impact, then you're probably not counting correctly. It's really hard to quantify something like that. And it seemed to me that it had the kind of wealth had more to do with sensing than with wanting, so to say.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, one can humbly quantify, understanding that the calculation will always be incomplete. And I think that's okay, right? Like, if I'm selling you my carrots, like, it's useful for me to tell you I gave you 5 carrots. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. I can't imagine a future where we're not tracking and understanding different variables, especially when you think about global trade and when you think about migration patterns that will happen and the fact we're going to need to grow a lot more food and not a lot less land, that we're going to have billions of forcibly displaced people. Like, we'll need an accounting system for that, to know where to send food to who and where and how. And it's not going to be, I can't imagine it being a sort of, you know, techno-agrarian, you know, every little bioregion's happy. You mentioned cities. Like, we'll understand how we get food in and out of cities, waste. Our technologies are getting more and more sophisticated in how they do that accounting. So we'll need the quantification. It's just not in my definition of a good life, because I don't count the amount of people I love. I just know I'm loved. You know what I mean? But I think that part of a fully functioning human civilization will require quantification of some form. How it's done now, that might look very different to how we do it today.
Uh-huh. Do you think it's possible to quantify dreams?
Define quantify in that context.
Okay, so I'm going to tell a story that I learned from Bernard Lieter, who taught me a lot about money. Bernard was the head of the Central Bank of Belgium before he was one of the architects of the euro, and met him 20 years ago, and he blew my mind about how money works and what it does to us. And he had this beautiful story about an issue that the city of Ghent had. So they had this part of town with many, many illegal immigrants who didn't have the possibility to work because they couldn't get legalized or didn't get themselves legalized so they could get jobs. And that came with all of the downward spiral that usually comes with that. Substance abuse, violence throughout that part of town. And so nobody knew what to do. The national government called Benar to ask him, do you have an idea how to deal with this? However, why ever they came up with asking Benar, who knows? But he went in there and he asked the people, what's your dream? What do you dream of? And they told him, we dream of having a little piece of land so we can grow something. So he got a piece of land from the city. He made it accessible by earning tokens. And that tokens could only be earned by doing things that would make the environment better. So you could get tokens for being nice to your neighbors, for putting flowers in the windows, for cleaning the street, for all of these things. And next to nothing, the whole thing changed. Because as you earlier pointed out, we are a function of our environment. And he had some token mechanism in there, so something had to be counted. But it was more based on objective understanding than on qualification of something than on quantification. And he had this beautiful dream that took me years to understand, about how he wanted to create a Central Bank of Dreams, Global Central Bank of Dreams, where everybody would deposit or put in their dream as a backing mechanism for their own currency. Now, if I create something that increases the value of the Alexa dream, you can mint Alexa token and give them to me. That's cool, but nobody's interested in Alexa, or only a few people are interested in Alexa token. So it's not actually a market function. It's a token of appreciation. But as everybody fulfills each other's dreams, or helps fulfilling each other's dreams, his hope was that then we would get rid of the need for tokens in the first place for quantification. That's why I'm asking.
I love that example. It's so interesting. It's funny. I mean, do you think that the people of that place would have done that without the tokens? Because it makes me think of Michael Sandel's book, right? The Moral Limit to Markets. And this idea that when you replace intrinsic civic reasons for doing something with extrinsic motives or financial compensation, it often erodes the intrinsic reason for doing that thing. And it can be very hard to even get those values back. And so when you look at how values are made and created in society, I think about this a lot in terms of rewarding people for protecting or regenerating nature. You know, it's the same thing that, like, when you, like, the difference between like putting a penalty on something or not. Like when parents are fined for going late to pick up their kids from school, the amount of late parents actually increases because then there's a monetary value attached to that transaction versus like, I should be a good parent and pick up my kid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are replete examples in behavioral economics that show this kind of behavior in human beings. So I'm delighted to hear that town improved based on, you know, their dreams. And I'd be curious to understand how the tokens fit and if they remove the tokens, if it didn't erode those intrinsic reasons for doing things, and if they just needed the money initially, I'd be very curious about that. But to your bigger point, I think that, of course, you can't quantify a dream. It's like, you know, can you quantify a cloud? It's like it's constantly morphing and taking a new input and shooting out lightning and like getting some rain and taking up the color of the light, you know, the sunset light. No. No, but from dreams, you can derive KPIs. You know what I mean? Yes. Like from a dream, you need to then like, you know, and then the laundry and then the email. Like there's also like this element of practicality to getting stuff done in this terrestrial plane. So I think it's a very interesting dance. And I think even just being aware of it and the fact that you put a number on anything, you've already kind of partially killed a part of it. You know, like just being aware of that is important.
Well, that's interesting. So the awareness of the reduction that we impose on something by quantifying it could allow us to treat it as if it were not quantified, but actually make it transactionable in a way.
It's just more honest. It's just more honest. It's like, let's agree that, you know, just because we're measuring nature doesn't mean that we understand what the hell it is or why the hell this otter, you know, what the life world of this otter is. But we do know that if otters are present in a kelp ecosystem, you know, you get 60% more spreading of the kelp seeds. Like those things matter too, right? So I think it's with all the people that I like to be with and work with, it's always like understanding the concept of the eye can be an illusion, but yeah, there is an eye. It's like, can we hold all of these paradoxes that exist inside of being human, all these dialectics where both things can often be true? I think that's very important.
I feel far from complete in this conversation, but I'm a little bit worried about time because you have a full day ahead of yourself.
Yeah.
And so, I'm going to move us towards a closing, but I'm really looking forward to a continuation of this exploration at one point. we touched upon many things, and there's something beginning to emerge that I can more sense than really point my finger to, regardless of being able to articulate it. But I can feel something. It's something that is the world that we would receive if you were in charge and were to create the world for us.
Hopefully you want to be inside of it, be a participant.
Yeah, it feels good. It feels good.
All right, good. Yes. Good, good, good.
Yeah. So if I put you in charge, and so if I give you godlike powers today, and you get the chance to give us every human on this planet an insight that sits so deep, like it comes so natural, like breathing, that makes it easier for us to live in a way and be in a way that is aligned with what you're dreaming and hoping and building for. What insight or concept would you give us?
Oh man, it's such a tough question. Because the answer I want to give you is way too abstract. Like the answer I want to give you is around non-duality, you know, this philosophical principle.
Before you go, and I want you to go.
Yeah.
I learned something last week from Nora Bateson. She said, and this freed me up very much, that most of the time when people ask for something concrete and tell you that it's too abstract, they're actually not saying it's abstract. They're saying, I don't understand. So, challenge us.
Thank you for the permission. Idea. Thank you for the permission. So it's almost like a quality of mind that anyone could receive, right? Versus like some kind of physical, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Because, you know, you can speak about resilience, patience, tolerance, compassion, you know, seeking understanding, all these things. But in the people I've encountered in my life, they stem from those who have some kind of understanding of a world that's larger than them, you know, belonging to a larger whole, whether that's you belong to this forest or you belong to the galaxy or, you know, but it's some decentering of the I. In some version or form, where maybe it's not like a complete, you know, ego death, or it's not a, you know, I am the mountain and everything around me, but just some very visceral and embodied sense that you are contained inside of these multitudes and that you depend upon them and rely on them and feed them yourself with what you are. Because there's such profound beauty in that. You know, we haven't spoken about beauty today, but for me, this is about beauty, the answer to the question. It's when one can inhabit that wider sphere, it's profoundly beautiful. And I think from that beauty can arise a lot of sincere action because you hold the kind of sacredness at the center of things. So sense of beauty and sacredness that comes along with that, I think is how I'll fumblingly answer your question.
Well, that's so fumblingly, I think. So we would receive from you a deep embodied sense of our interbeing, interwovenness into every other last bit of life on this planet. And you would do that, you would give us that because that would give rise to a sense of the sacredness and the beauty of it all that would stop us from destroying things and from even being able to destroy things. That's what I'm hearing.
It would make it a lot harder. Yeah, I think a lot of positive qualities emerge from that state of mind. Mm-hmm. It's well summarized. Thank you.
Well, thank you for giving this to us. I'd really appreciate that. And thank you for this morning for you, this evening for me. I feel energized, actually, after a long day, long, intense day. And I feel like the surface area of my soul has been increased through this conversation.
That's a beautiful image.
So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on and for doing this wonderful project that will hopefully and surely inspire many people.